Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco's oldest, most innovative public radio station.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. And Ken, this week we're actually continuing a conversation that in a way was started by William James at that very corner in 1906 when he gave his great speech about a moral equivalent to war. For many people think that sports, with its ideals of teamwork and what used to be called the manly virtues, is a way of getting the moral benefits of war without paying the price in death and destruction. What do you think of that?
Well, I think there's something right about that. I mean, you know, why ethics in sports? You've started one reason. It's a way of sublimating, as it were, our competitive juices into something that produces something beautiful, something calling up forth human excellence. But, you know, there's also just that excellence is really on display. Human excellence, human virtue. Right? I mean, people have to discipline themselves. They strive for distant goals. They work really hard. They forego the immediate pleasure. They learn to share and contribute to collective enterprises by, you know, sports is a cool thing for that reason alone, if for nothing else. And many sports are beautiful.
Well, I'm sure that's true. I don't think anyone ever called me beautiful in my athletic career.
Yeah, well,
I played sports in high school and 1 year of college, and I think the main virtue I got out of it was modesty.
Yeah, well-deserved modesty, I say.
But a lot of people, I think, that sports is their first time to really see that the rules have to be obeyed. The umpire can't be talked out of things the way mom and dad can be.
Yeah.
Teamwork is necessary. And most of us learn that there are people better at doing the various things we do than we are. And that's very helpful.
Well, there's another thing about sports I think is cool. When you, going back to the war metaphor, when you are at war with somebody and you vanquish them, you dominate them, you take over their land, you do all kinds of bad things to them. When you beat somebody in a sports contest, especially a well-played sports contest, what do? You tip your hat to them. You respect them as an opponent in a shared undertaking. I mean, even though they lost and you won, still there's this enduring respect that you have for a formidable opponent that you've
Well, in the Little League and AYSO soccer, the teams always shake hands. Everybody shake hands with everybody else on both teams at the end. Do they do that in pro football?
Well, I think they used to, but I don't think they do anymore. You know, there is, though, lest we sound just like Pollyannas, there is a dark underbelly of sports, and we're going to have to, you know, steroids, cheating, all kinds of things, college students forgoing their academic pursuits in order to play their sports. I mean, there's all kinds of bad stuff happening. We're going to talk about that, too.
Not everybody learns modesty like I did. Some people just seem to get inflated egos, inflated salaries, and become despicable human beings. So,
yeah.
So there's kind of two dimensions of ethics in sports. The ideal that kind of comes from the Greeks and then the other side, the effect on our society.
Yeah. But you know what? Look, we're going to talk about the effect on our society for good and ill, the dark underbelly. We're going to dig into that. But for the moment, it's just worth focusing on the display of human excellence on the playing field. Amy Standen went out and did her usual thing. She files this report.
Say what you want about Terrell Owens, the Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver, but that 30-yard run he made in Super Bowl 39, sprinting on an ankle he'd broken only 6 weeks before, was nothing if not a feat of extraordinary athleticism.
McNabb throws a leaping catch made by Owens to the 40, 35, 30, 25, 20, taken out of bounds, and a flag is thrown up.
I think there's no question that sport can be used as an example for people to see athletes, men and women, under extraordinary pressure, using the greatest talents that they were given and doing something that requires extraordinary art. We can learn an awful lot from that.
Frank DeFord is an NPR commentator and a senior writer for Sports Illustrated.
Something I saw on television just a week ago when Roger Federer, who is indisputably the greatest tennis player alive today, and some people think by the time he retires he may be the greatest ever to have played the game. And he was slightly injured, and he got beat in a very, very tough match. It was the first time he'd lost in months. He was actually down on his knees when the match ended. And he came to the net, and he and Murat Safin, who had beaten him, embraced. I think you learn something from that. I think you take something away from just that one little tableau of two men who have fought each other for 4 hours and then can clasp hands and put their arms around each other and say, good job, win or lose, good job. I think that what good sportsmanship means is playing the game as best as you can, playing the game in a clean fashion, not being simply a dirty player. Playing the game with the right attitude, which is to say, the appreciation that at least half the people are going to lose in any sport. And you have to understand that. And maybe if you are a good sport and you live up to morals on the athletic field, maybe that makes you more cognizant of applying the right kind of behavior in the rest of your life.
That may be true, but why is sports considered better moral training than, say, playing the piano or fixing cars?
What's different about sports is that it's visible. You're playing with other people who can watch what you do. So in many respects, morality is more enforced in sports because you can't get away with it. We can cheat at home on our taxes and hope that nobody sees it. It's very hard to cheat in sports without eventually getting caught.
And as for the idea that back in the olden days, athletes were noble, good, and always played fair, DeFord says it's a myth.
You go back to 100 years ago, and the President of the United States himself, Teddy Roosevelt, had to call in the presidents of Princeton, Harvard, and Yale and say, straighten out football, or I'm going to ban it. I'm going to find a way to ban it, which was the ultimate reason that the NCAA was created. But to suggest that somehow our forefathers on the athletics field were all absolute paragons, little George Washingtons, is nonsense. I think, if anything, it's probably the same now as it was then. We're talking about human nature here. That just goes with the human condition.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy. We got some insight there about the possibilities of noble athletic endeavor, and also learned a little bit about the founding of the NCAA, which, strange to modern ears, had to do with over-competitiveness in football with Princeton and Harvard.
Yeah, right.
What do you think of that, Ken?
I don't know. You know, you would have expected there would have been some other colleges, maybe, that was...
Like maybe your alma mater, Notre Dame.
Yeah. But
and
anyway.
And my home, Nebraska. Hey,
speaking about the NCAA, joining us today from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis is Dr. Miles Brand. Miles is the current president of the NCAA. He spent many years as a professor of philosophy, by the way. That's his best job, I think. He's also been a university provost, a university president at universities with big-time athletic programs. He's the man who fired the controversial Indiana basketball coach, Bobby Knight. We should also say he's on the board of advisors for this program. Miles, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Pleasure to be here.
Hi, Miles. John Perry here. Let me start our conversation on a firm philosophical footing. The philosopher Hegel thought that war was a great thing because all the manly virtues got exercised and people learned teamwork and everybody worked together. The philosopher William James said, oh, baloney, Hegel. What we need is a moral equivalent to war, another way of getting at those virtues. Many people think sports plays that role. Is that part of your devotion to sports?
I don't think that sports plays the same role as war, but it does play a role of encouraging and certain values in our society, such as teamwork and hard work, the role of competition, well played, the care for the body as well as the mind. So I think sports does promote certain strong values and values that I think any good philosopher should promote, but I wouldn't really equate it to war.
Well, I think the moral equivalent was the important thing, that it's not war, but it plays the function that war might play, only it does it better without the downside cost. But, you know.
No, it doesn't play it any better than, say, Greek tragedy. The fact is that they share some commonalities, and some use the same metaphors, like the long bomb, fighting in the trenches as you use in football. So some of the same metaphors, but I think there are other ways to have cathartic effects about war without playing sports, and tragedy might do that.
Well, still, when you look at the big game, which out here is Berkeley versus Stanford, and you see all the energy that goes into it, all the mobilization of efforts, not just the football players, but the cheerleaders, both men and women, and the students. And some people say, God, isn't that a waste? Why don't they put that into their studies? But, you know, that's not really a human possibility. The question is, isn't it a good thing that the Stanford students just aren't going over to Berkeley and beating everybody up, which, since Berkeley is three times as large, wouldn't be a very good idea.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think the ability to celebrate and get involved and has some nationalistic analogies to it, and maybe that's why you think it resembles war, but the fact is a human celebration, the engagement in a high-level activity, feeling part of something larger than yourself, all that is part of sports, and certainly you experience it as well in the stadium, but interestingly, fans experience it home on the couch as well. So there is something about the spectator and being part of the action, at least live vicariously, that makes sports so interesting and why so many enthusiastic sports fans continue to tune in week after week.
Miles, when we go back to the Greeks who had this ideal, athletic ideal that we still borrow ideas from, they also, as I understand it, had the idea of the amateur. And that's been a big problem, maybe a conceptual problem, maybe a practical problem in modern athletics. How do you see the difference between amateurs, like the NCAA has to do with, and professionals?
The notion of amateur is crucial to intercollegiate athletics. As you well know, it came over from the British, which was a class distinction. The upper class didn't want to mingle with the lower class, and so that's why they didn't pay the players, and only the upper class can afford to do it. But today, amateur in college sports could mean several different things. It could mean that you aren't paid for your activity, or it could mean that it's not your primary activity. You're an amateur as if your primary activity, for example, is being a philosophy professor, and on the side you enjoy playing in a jazz band. You're an amateur in the jazz band. You do that for fun, and you do that with others, but the fact is you're a professional philosopher, a professional university teacher. So I think it's that latter sense, namely that it isn't your primary preoccupation that makes you an amateur in intercollegiate sports.
Yeah, there's
your primary preoccupation clearly is to get a degree.
There's another sense of amateur, though, which I think you're rightly distinguishing from it's not your primary preoccupation. Sometimes you say, well, he's an amateur philosopher, meaning he's not very good at it, right?
And right.
But, of course, and you might think that the reason he's not very good at it is because he doesn't spend much time doing it. He doesn't train himself. He doesn't have the fine-honed training. Of course, college athletics, there's a high degree of excellence. Go ahead.
That is a legitimate sense of being an amateur. I don't think it's the applicable sense here, though, because you rightly point out in some sports, for example, swimming, gymnastics, students who play these sports in college are Olympic quality and as good as anyone in the world. Amateur here means that your preoccupation is with something else, or at least should be with something else.
But see, that's the paradox, though. I mean, if it's not your primary thing, but you want to achieve a high level of excellence, how do you do that? I mean, professional football players and professional basketball players, they devote themselves full time. Even in the off season, they're working like crazy to perfect their skills, to keep their body in shape. Given the high level of expectation for college athletics, I mean, don't they, in effect, have to make their sport their full-time occupation? And doesn't that raise a problem for the university? I mean,
I don't think so. Most student athletes can walk and chew gum at the same time. They can do more than one thing at once. They can be students, and they can do something else. You know, some students, not necessarily in Berkeley and Stanford, but some students have to work. And they work a number of hours a week, 20 or more hours a week for some, and still are excellent students. Students can do more than one thing at once. We have a rule in the NCAA that you're not supposed to practice and partake in sports more than 20 hours a week. That allows time to be both a student and a proficient athlete.
Okay, Miles, we're going to take that up a little bit more. I want to challenge you a little bit on that. I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with the president of the NCAA, President Miles Brand, about ethics in sports. We'd like you to join our conversation. You can do so by calling 415-841-4134.
We've been discussing the ideals that we think of with regard to sports, but often sports falls far from the ideal. Give us a call and tell us, has sports made you a better person, or were you more affected by the ways in which athletics falls far from its ideals? You can call us toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. You can send us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Neither left nor to right, straight through the heart of them righteous uprights. Drop kick me, Jesus, through the goalposts of life.
Bobby Bear would drop kick me Jesus through the goalposts of life, a song no doubt inspired by Notre Dame University, Ken's alma mater,
yeah,
where
right.
touchdown Jesus towers over the home goalposts.
Yeah, he hasn't been looking over Notre Dame too much recently, though.
Yeah, he's been looking the other way. I'm John Perry. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is the president of the NCAA, Dr. Miles Brand. Our question for you, the audience, is do big-time college sports programs compromise the educational mission of the university, or is it just completely consistent?
You can give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. For those listening to our live webcast, you can dial 1-800-525-9917. Once again, 1-800-525-9917 from anywhere in the U.S. or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Miles, I remember reading a speech of yours that you gave, it was in 2001 or something, it was before you became president of the NCAA, in which you talked about the crisis, or I don't know if you use that word, facing college athletics. Look, you know, lots of people, I mean, you said college athletes should, you know, be amateurs, and they should devote their primary task should be, you know, their studies. But, you know, lots of people don't believe that's the case, especially at, like, the big football, basketball factories. And you acknowledged in this speech, as I recall, there was a crisis and you had lots of ideas about reform. I mean, isn't there a crisis? I mean, isn't there pressure on these young men and women, you know, especially in the high-revenue sports, baseball, football and basketball? Isn't there, you know, to be like pros?
Yes, I think we do have a serious problem. And verging on a crisis. I haven't changed my mind on that. The fact is that there are 360,000 student-athletes playing into collegiate athletics right now. The vast majority of them are enjoying participating in college sports, and it adds to their education and their life development. In the sports of men's basketball and football, there are a few sports, a few in each team of on the major schools, who see their college playing days as a preparation for a professional game. Very few, even in those teams, reach that, but some do perceive that. What I'm concerned about is that that view of the few doesn't migrate to the larger number, and most of the student-athletes don't get a good education because they're focused elsewhere. We need to control that.
I agree with you about that. Look, we have amazing sports teams at Stanford, and we have amazing students, and most of the student athletes are both amazing athletes and amazing students, and I really admire them. I mean, they work hard at both things, and they're really cool young people. But, you know, there is this big kind of elephant in the room, football and basketball across the country in major universities, and it seems to me, I don't know. I don't know what you think. Well, it seems to me a mess.
Let me throw a comment in there. I was a resident fellow with my wife, Frenchie, for 6 years in the dorms at Stanford. And I found that actually some of the other sports, particularly those related to swimming, water polo, and so forth, really were more time-consuming and more diverting from the studies than football and basketball. For one reason, the students really were under a lot of pressure to continue with the practices year-round, although they couldn't actually be required to do so. So maybe personal ambitions are one thing, but sometimes even if the students keep those in perspective, they get a lot of pressure to put enormous amounts of time into these sports.
Well, I think that's true. I agree with that. Even though we have rules of 20 hours a week, sometimes the swimmers will go off to the Y and swim on their own. You know, student athletes on average in Division I graduate at a higher rate than the general student body, about 2 percentage points, which turns out to be statistically significant. That doesn't mean student-athletes in every sport beat the general student body in graduation
right.
rates. Football is just 2% below the male general population rate, so they come pretty close, and that's in part because football players tend to stay in school at least 3 years, 4 years, sometimes 5 years. But in some sports, baseball, notoriously men's basketball, the graduation rate is seriously below the general male population, and that presents a problem.
Miles, I want to... you know, I go back and forth about this stuff, and especially thinking about the big-time college sports and their sullying, let's call it, of the educational mission of the university. And I'm of two different minds, and I waffle, and both of them are kind of radical. Sometimes I think we should just get out of this business. We should just let the major league football run its own minor leagues. And maybe we could have teams, but we could like they could be like completely separate from the university in the sense that they could just license our name or something like that, right? We just get out of this. Or we should go whole hog into this business. We should just say these student athletes are athletes and we should pay them and stop exploiting them and stop pretending, yeah. You know?
I don't like either route. You know, the modern university is a very complex institution. Let's not become too elitist and think the only thing we're interested in is in the liberal arts, although you and I are in the liberal arts and we love it and think fondly of it. But the modern university runs the healthcare system in many states. We did that in Indiana. We had the only medical school and the largest market share for all our hospitals. Tech transfer, Stanford has been pretty good at that, to their credit. So the modern university includes many aspects beyond the liberal arts curriculum. And it includes also this ability to participate in large-scale sports for some schools. Done in the right way, under the control of the university, and making sure that the students, athletes, have a genuine opportunity to succeed academically, it's a good thing.
Okay.
It could get out of hand, and we've seen that. But I think if you regulate it well and keep the attitudes right, it's a positive attribute of universities.
Okay, Miles, but let me push you a little on your philosopher side. You're a philosopher president of the NCAA, but suppose you were a philosopher king. Suppose you were designing a society from ground up. What role would you have for sports? And wouldn't it differ? I mean, would you really give colleges the job they have in as important as athletics are in promoting athletics? How would your ideal society deal with sports?
Of course, in the Republic, the Guardians were engaged in sports. That was an important part of their education. And in fact, American higher education differs from the rest of the world. Indeed, our educational system differs from the rest of the world in integrating sports at a very early age into the educational system. I think there's something to be said for that. If anyone thinks that all that happens in a university is you listen to lectures and read textbooks, they don't know the first thing about a university education. A university education takes teenagers, 18, 19-year-olds, helps them understand their value systems, lets them form life plans, certainly helps build character. Those kinds of attributes, those educational developmental attributes, are certainly built into the sports systems that we have, and that's the good part of it. It can get out of hand, and we have to control that. But I think athletics, done right, is an important part of the American higher education system, and I think a positive attribute of it.
I think there's an argument to be had for that. I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking to Miles Brand, president of the NCAA. You can join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. That's if you're in the Bay Area. If you're listening online, as we hope lots of you are, you can dial 1-800-525-9917, and we have lots of callers in the line. Ellen in Richmond, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ellen.
Yes, hi there.
Hi, what's your comment or question?
Well, I'm a sport and exercise psychologist, and I agree with Dr. Brand in saying that athletics has incredible potential. But I wanted to point out to the audience that there's a whole field of kinesiology that studies these questions in an academic way.
Yeah.
There are sport philosophy courses and journals, and so many of the questions that you've raised today are discussed and have been researched.
That's right.
My own area in moral development in sport, we find that the most common joke is that sport does it build character or characters, and that in a passive way, you know, all the elements are there, but unless it's consciously taught, we can actually develop people that overvalue winning, athletics over being a student.
What's your answer to your own question? Is it more often build character or characters?
In fact.
Well, it depends. I think these days we're building probably a lot more characters, but I think that's if you maybe look at more of the professional sport and maybe at the high level Division I. I think sometimes we take our eyes off the fact that not all of sport is Division I. There's Division II, Division III, there's high school, there's youth sports, and that those are wonderful grounds to be able to develop the qualities that we want to develop. But if we're always looking towards the professional model and always looking towards, the emphasis on who's going to win in the college game, then the emphasis is on winning. And when the emphasis is on winning, people are apt to do things that sacrifice.
Well, I think you're exactly right. It's a nice distinction. I know I've coached youth soccer and some other sports, and you build a lot of character, but the characters on the pro level that the kids are looking at sometimes get in the way.
Well, yeah, and I mean, there's this trickle down. And I think one of the problems with college and high school and pre-high school is the stuff that's happening in the pro level is trickling down. Everybody wants their kids to get to the pros. They want their kids to succeed, to achieve this high level of excellence. And the bar is being ratcheted up by all this stuff that's happening in the pros. And I don't think that's a healthy development. But we've got some more callers in the line. Chris in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chris.
Hi. I was thinking how you couldn't really generalize about sports in general, but looking at them separately, like boxing, for instance, I'm sure you can make an argument as being destructive, and I'm sure it's illegal in some places, whereas basketball is a different thing. Also, sports news can be used to sort of lead us away from what's really important in terms of wars and this and that. So to some degree, it's used as a distraction, and I think you have to look at each one separately in terms of their helpfulness to the people and et cetera. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks,
Chris. Miles, we've had a lot been said here. What do you think about anything that's been said recently?
Well, I thought the distinction between professional sports and those engaged in professional sports and what happens in college is a critically important distinction that we have to hold on to. The college game is different. Think of basketball, for example. In basketball, it's the team. It's Stanford, it's Berkeley, it's Duke, it's Indiana, it's North Carolina. When we look at the pro game in basketball, it's the individual stars. And that's they market the stars in order to create revenue for those who own the teams. And that's just not what happens in college. It's a different game. And it's a game that contributes to the well-being of the student, athletes, and to the general institution, if done right.
Well, I agree with you, Miles, but sometimes I have some misgivings. When I came to Stanford in 1968, the way the Pac-8 worked was that basketball games were on Friday and Saturday, and the two teams in the Bay Area would go down to L.A. or vice versa, or Oregon or Washington. It had a little impact on the students' schedule. Nowadays, under the pressure of television, they play basketball games all week long. Isn't television kind of blurring the distinction you're talking about?
And let me add that. I think that's a really important point, Miles. Look, You said something I think is really important. I want to underline it. We as universities, what are we in this for? Well, we're in it for the good of society. I mean, our whole production of knowledge and dissemination, that's supposed to be a social good. But we're also in it for the good of the students who are in our charge. And college athletics, if it's to be a benefit, it has to be aimed at their good, right? But you know what? Television comes in, these big multi-million-dollar contracts, all this commercialization. I mean, The networks want a Super Bowl of college football. They're dying. You know they're dying to have you guys do that, right? And they just drive so much of this. How do you resist that pressure?
You know, just to interject, and they use ethical arguments. They say it's unfair to the fans and the athletes not to have a national football champion. I bet you don't buy that argument, Miles.
No, I don't, and I think Ken's comment is exactly right. In the end, intercollegiate athletics, sports in general, is all about the participants. It's about the students, just as universities are really, in the end, all about the students. We do lots of other things in universities, and sports have lots of other connections, but if you don't bring it back home to the students, something's wrong. Now, what commercialism on its face is not bad, because it allows for fan coverage that wouldn't otherwise take place. It isn't just those sitting in the stadium that could watch. The fact of the matter is we have to be able to resist. As you both know, the NCAA schools, not the NCAA itself since it's not involved in postseason football, but the NCAA schools have resisted the temptation to produce a college version of the Super Bowl. I think that's good. That's healthy. And the presidents are doing it because they value the traditions in college sports, in this case the bowl games. You know, Stanford's a great university. It also is not only a great academic institution, but year after year, it turns out on what we call the Director's Cup, which school does best overall in sports always wins.
Yeah.
Stanford does well in both.
We're really proud of that.
We're very proud of that. Although even at Stanford, now one thing we haven't talked about is women and the revolution in the participation of women in sports. I think that's been all to the good, but. But I know at Stanford we have so many student athletes now that it's beginning to be hard to schedule classes because they're all practicing in the afternoon and some of them are practicing in the morning. But I digress. Let's. What do you see as the benefits of all this women?
Wait a minute. Well, you're talking about the plus side. I might as well get the minus side in there, too, or at least what some people say is the minus side. I was a wrestler in college at Notre Dame, and my wrestling program is gone, and hundreds of them across the country are gone.
You're not
going
to tell me it's to blame it on Title IX. I don't want to hear that.
I'm not going to say that. Some people attribute it to Title IX.
Is that what happened to your looks, too much wrestling? I mean, were you good-looking before you
got in? Come on. What's your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I would contend that the most important piece of legislation for higher education in the second half of the 20th century was Title IX. Title IX came in 1972, first of all, to provide opportunities at post-baccalaureate level in professional schools, such as law and medicine and business, for women. It also, incidentally, affected sports. Since that time, the number of women participating in sports has gone up 10 times. About 40% of the student athletes are now women. To the extent that intercollegiate athletics and sports in general provide these character building opportunities, these educational development opportunities, why would we give those to men and not for women? Now, let me go back to the point about television, because it's related. One of the ways in which a university can support 22 or 30 teams, half of which are women, is by having a few revenue sports, there are only really two, football and men's basketball, that throw off enough revenue in order to provide the scholarship, the coaching, the facilities necessary for all these other sports, including those that involve women.
Look,
and that's good.
Okay, I agree with you. We'll take that up some more after the break. Remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing ethics in sports with NCAA President Dr. Miles Brand.
It's not often you have the ear of the president of the NCAA. So if you've got some questions out there in Radio Land, if you've got some ideas for reforming college athletics, give us a call and bend Miles Brand's ear a bit.
You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. That's if you're listening in the Bay Area. And for those of you listening from all around the world via the Internet, you can join us, too, by calling 800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Philosophy Talk, we'll be right back.
Cheech and Chong with Basketball Jones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about ethics in sports with NCAA President Dr. Miles Brand. We'd like you to join us as well. Now, suppose that we made you king of the NCAA for a day. Not just a president, because the president can't dictate. But suppose we made you the king. How would you reform college athletics? What would you do? Would you make students' athletics be paid? Just fess up to the commercialization of college sports? Or would you prohibit them from joining the pros too early? Give us your ideas. Call 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
And for those of you outside the Bay Area, you can join us too. Call 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Let's get some more callers in here. Sean in Mill Valley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sean.
Thank you for having me. I don't dispute the benefits to the individuals who participate in the sports, but to shift the focus a little more to the fans than the athletes, I'm concerned about how many people I see that are unable to actually participate in sports, but they devote a huge amount of time and money to watching and living vicariously through their sports to the exclusion of what, to me, are more pressing issues. To me, it's kind of become a secular version of the opiate of the masses that keeps people distracted from more important things of the day. And then another thing, if you could touch on, is your thoughts on, like, the World Cup soccer matches where people are actually getting killed in the stands, that people use their sports as a substitute for increased nationalism. That may not be the focus of your program today. But
Sean, would you, if people devoted as much time to, say, watching the opera or listening to the symphony or watching ballet as they do the sports, would that bother you? I mean, the reason I ask that is I think a well-played match of many different kinds are objects of beauty, and observing beauty enriches human life immeasurably. I don't get your attitude.
Well, I guess it's born of things like I have friends that I know that only read the sports page. They do not read anything else about what's going on.
Not even the comics? That's terrible. Yeah, that's terrible, comics. Yeah.
But you know, there are a lot of people that get very, very wrapped up in their sports, and I participate in sports myself. I would have no problem with people going to ballet, opera, et cetera, but to the exclusion of other things is what my concern is.
Thanks, Sean.
I do get your point of view. Thank you, Sean. I do get your point of view. I think it's a valid point. People often spend time doing things that they could do better things than. As a person who does a lot of those things, I think sports is one of the relatively innocuous ones.
Miles, what do you think?
I think we have to be careful here of classism and elitism. Yeah. Some people prefer to spend their time reading books, going to symphony. I enjoy that as well. Some people prefer to spend their time watching sports. I do that as well. You know, sports is reality TV par excellence. The most interesting part about the sports programming is you don't know how it's going to end. It's not scripted. It's exciting. People put their heart and soul into it. You do live vicariously a little bit, and that's thrilling and exciting. But we shouldn't put it down just because it's not high art.
Well, let me put in 2 cents for sports in the following way. If you're going to waste your time and not, you know, improve your mind or pay attention to politics, one advantage sports has is its intergenerational possibilities. I mean, sports is the one thing I could always talk to my dad about, even during the Vietnam War when we were, you know, dead set against each other on most other issues. And I've always been able to talk to my children about sports. We talk about other things occasionally, too. But sports, it's really always there. And that's a great role it plays in society, even for the non-participants.
We have a caller in line who wants to take issue, I think, with something Miles said. Christopher is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Christopher in Oakland. What's your comment or question, Christopher?
Hello, sir. So I've enjoyed your philosophy on a lot of these points. But I grew up in a my parents were at a big state school in Indiana, and in a very competitive high school basketball program, which was totally life-consuming and character-forming, or it formed a lot of characters. And then I went later on and played in a very mellow volleyball program at Princeton. And that was an example of what I think I've heard about doing it right and seeing it how it can be an enriching situation. But I see so many examples of where it's not done right. And at these state schools like Ball State, where I went, it seemed like those 95 football players in a revenue-losing program were being paid for by the rest of the university. And those were 95 scholarships that weren't going to students.
So your challenge to Miles is, I'm not quite sure what your challenge to Miles is.
My question is, he's often said, when done right, a sports program in colleges can be a helpful and beneficial thing for the students. And I'm saying, but there are so many overwhelming examples of when it's not done right. How can those? How can that legislation or whatever regulation be really effective?
Okay, Miles. Thanks, Christopher. Miles, what do you think about Christopher's challenge to you?
Actually, I think it's done right in the vast majority of cases. I just heard of Princeton volleyball. I assume it's done right. They have a wonderful athletics program there. There are, again, 360,000 student athletes we probably pay attention to in the newspapers and on TV to a couple of hundred. Many students participate. Coaches are concerned about the welfare of their students. They're concerned about whether they graduate. They act as mentors to the students. We don't hear a lot about that. That's true. We do focus on the aberrant cases. In the cases that when something does go wrong, we need to fix it. Now, the good news is I think we're getting some traction on that in the last couple of years. We're beginning to see a much more emphasis on academic success as well as athletic success. Of course, there'll always be a handful of students who see college sports as an entryway into professional sports, but they're a very small number, and that should not be our focus. It's the vast majority of students who play intercollegiate athletics who get a great deal out of it. Let's pay more attention to them.
Well, that's fine, Miles. But now moving kind of into the part of our program where we're going to think about future reforms. You're a reform-minded head of the NCAA. You're probably irritating lots of college presidents and coaches with everything you say. But suppose you weren't just president. Suppose you were king. Suppose you could enact some reforms just by a stroke of the pen. Let me give you a concrete one. Would you say that all the leagues ought to be like the Ivy League, with their relative de-emphasis on some of the worse aspects of intercollegiate athletics?
You know, the analogy here is with higher education. One of the great aspects of American higher education is its diversity of institutions, small state school, large state schools, very prestigious small liberal arts schools in New England, large private schools in the West Coast like Stanford and others. The fact is, higher education, because of its diversity, and for each student then being able to find a place within that diverse educational system, works. I'd say the same thing for college athletics. There's nothing wrong that goes on in the Ivy Leagues, nothing wrong that goes on in Division III, which has no scholarships at all. I don't think that there is by itself anything wrong with high visibility, high profile sports. It suits some students and it suits some fans and institutions as well. We have to allow for that diversity.
Miles, I want to be a little more pessimistic. I don't know if you'll slap my pessimism down. But I think, for the most part, I think you're right. And I think there's a reason it can work for most sports, because there aren't these massive professional leagues holding out the lure of millions upon millions of dollars. And there aren't huge television contracts for college soccer. I mean, college soccer is a fine sport, but, you know, you don't see it on television very much. It doesn't have a huge sort of media following. Put the pressure. So universities, we said, we're dedicated to the students' good and to the social good, right? And that's our mission. And so in college sports, that's our mission. But bump that against the capitalist reproduction of sports, to talk a little fancy, right, which is driven by profit and ratings and all. Put those two things together. And it seems to me you've got this irreconcilable, you know, you've got the unmovable force and the unstoppable object bumping heads together. And I'm not so optimistic that the universities have the power to resist what the media and the audience have. They've got a huge audience. I'm not sure we have the power to resist.
So, Ken, you're saying Miles is standing between an irresistible force and an immovable object. That sounds like an interesting position to be in, Miles.
At least, I mean, not across the board. Not across the board, Miles. I think you're right. Not across the board. But where capitalism meets the university, which is non-capitalist, we've got this.
You know, I almost agree with that, but I would point to the individual rather than the university in this case. So let me be specific. I think we're having the most problem in terms of academic success in the area of basketball. Management and labor has gotten together in football and in baseball in order to assure that the student athletes are there in school at least 3 years before they enter the professional league. It's antitrust for the NCAA to try and interfere in that. But in basketball, that's not the case. So you can see young men going from high school directly into the pros or 1 year in college directly in the pros. I'm not worried about LeBron James, who earns multi-million dollars a year and is an athletic phenomena. He doesn't worry me. Who worries me are the thousands and thousands of young men who were in the 8th, 9th, and 10th grade, or even earlier than that, who believe they're going to grow up to be the next LeBron James, and don't pay attention to their studies, don't prepare themselves for college. The vast majority are going to get disappointed. And so if by the freshman or sophomore year of college, they're not really prepared to continue because they haven't met their athletic goal. Those are the people that I worry about. It's the television and the money and the commercialism not so much affecting the university, but it's affecting the attitudes of these young men, and they wind up with neither a college education or a professional career in sports, and they become part of a lost generation.
Yeah, we've got two last callers on the line. Paul, if you can be quick, let me have your comment.
Well, one comment to you who said something about wrestling. Wrestling and men's gymnastics had already diminished and were on their way out long before Title IX. So blaming Title IX, that is really just nonsense. Kids did not want to go to college to do this, unless the college ended with the word state, like Fresno State, Iowa State, Oregon State. The other question I have, though, is...
Briefly, Paul.
Yeah. Football. You take the University of Miami. You have somebody who was apparently an intelligent member of the cabinet, Donna Shalala. She has determined that they have to make more and more money. She's pushing her more and more into the role of a big football college, which it was already. And my concern would be this. Could we not, for example, instead of having BCS and arguing about this, maybe the schools that graduate the most football players could play for the championship? Or maybe we could take away scholarships where players just simply fail to meet their requirements.
Thanks.
Can I interject
Paul.
Here? Yeah. That last point is exactly what we're doing. We just put in academic reforms this past April, which says that if a team doesn't graduate its student-athletes, if they don't make genuine academic progress, we take away scholarships, eventually keep them out of postseason play, which will cost them money. That's exactly what we're doing. We've got to control this athletic buildup and continue to emphasize the academic side of the house.
Miles, that'll have to be our last word on the matter. It's been a great pleasure having you with us. Our guest today has been Dr. Miles Brand, president of the NCAA. Miles, thank you for joining us.
Great pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Miles.
So, John, what are you thinking today?
I mean, well, we covered a lot of ground. First of all, I'm convinced that the NCAA is very lucky to have Miles Brand as president. He may have an impossible job, but he's going to do a better with the impossible job than anyone else could. He's a reformer, but he's the kind of reformer who's not such a zealot that he can't get things done.
I think he has his eyes clearly on the ideal that we talked about at the beginning.
Yeah.
And he sees very clearly, I think, the challenges to that ideal, the ways in which sports has departed, especially college sports. We didn't ask him about the pros. And he's got some ideas for reform, so, you know.
Well, first we talk about the ethical ideal and the amateur in sports, and he was very helpful with that, giving us two different senses of amateur and the one that should pertain to college athletics and that he's making lots of efforts to make obtain. Then we spent a lot of time talking about how athletics departs from the ideal, and that was maybe the juicier part of the show.
Yeah, and, you know, these reform ideas of his. But you know what? I think it's a hard problem. I mean, I really do think that the commercialization of, not by the universities as much as by the media and the demand for it by the fans, that's a big engine of change in college sports, and I don't see that it's ever going to go away.
But to put it in context, the university's under a lot of pressures on the research front with grants and Defense Department funding a lot of research. There's lots of pressures on the colleges. It takes some very good people to resist them, to shape them, and to think them through.
Yeah. So we can't settle that all here. If you want to keep talking about this with us, though, you can log on to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. In about a week, our blog is going to be up and running. In the meantime, we'd like to thank our callers who didn't get a chance to we didn't get a chance to talk to. And for this part of the show, we'll give the last word to the band Steam.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earl.
Special thanks to Dave Fusaro, Nicole Sawaya, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwell Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.